Any town, USA. It's just another sunny day. But by the time the sun goes down, the people will be gathered around.
Mother!
Clementa Pinckney, Tywanza Sanders,
Amadou Diallo,
Sandra Bland,
Sharonda Coleman Singleton,
Walter Scott,
Susie Jackson,
Sean Bell,
Tamir Rice,
Ethel Lance,
Christian Taylor,
Cynthia Hurd,
Eric Garner,
Myra Thompson,
Trayvon Martin,
Daniel Simmons, DePayne Middleton Doctor,
Freddie Gray,
James Byrd,
Emmett Till,
Kamani Gray,
John Crawford III,
Columbine,
Sandy Hook,
Virginia Tech.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, the bluesologist based in the great, or the not-so-great white north here in Toronto, Canada. And we came out of the box tonight with Sweet Honey and the Rock, a group that did a song called Second Line Blues, called talking about the police bestiality. And it's a great, great song, and I'm looking forward to seeing Sweet Honey and the Rock when they perform in Toronto, Canada at Kerner Hall on February the 20th, that's a Saturday night. And I'm really looking forward to seeing them. I saw them the last time they were at Kerner Hall, but Sweet Honey in the Rock is always a treat to see, and they always come with the issues affecting Africa, Africans, and all oppressed people. And we would like to start this show like we start every show by thanking two people. We would like to thank Chairman O'Malley Ishitella, the chair of the African People's Socialist Party and the African Socialist International. He gave us the space to do Iceport Music on Uhuru Radio. We would also like to thank Archie Shepp. Archie Shepp gave us the concept of diasporic music. Music made in the West, but not of the West. And Archie Shepp and O'Malley Ishitella both are from Florida, for whatever that is worth. And we're going to have a speech today from Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Gerald Horn has a book out called The Black Jacobins, and The Black Jacobins is about the Haitian Revolution, and also it's about Santo Domingo. And we're going to feature a speech that he did at in New York. And we're going to play that speech in its entirety. We're going to break it up. And we're also going to be paying tribute to Nina Simone. Nina Simone, whose birthday is on February the 21st, which is African Martyrs Day. Nina Simone, a great singer, songwriter, human rights activist, pianist, and a woman that made tremendous contributions to the struggle of Africa. Africans and all oppressed people. And we're going to be paying tribute to Nina Simone. So right now it's time to check out, listen to some blues. Like I say, I'm a bluesologist. And CeeLo Green, I like CeeLo Green. CeeLo Green is out of Atlanta, Georgia. And there was a song that was originally recorded by Lattimore, and CeeLo Green re-recorded it recently, and we're going to play CeeLo Green's rendition of Let's Straighten It Out, Monica, and Usher's rendition of Let's Straighten It Out. Monica was 14 when she recorded Let's Straighten It Out, and I think Usher was 16. And then we're going to play the original rendition live by the great Lattimore, and the song is called Let's Straighten It Out.
Sit yourself down, girl, and talk to me. Tell me what's on your mind. Don't keep saying everything's okay, baby. 'Cause if it was, girl, you wouldn't be crying. You've been tossing and turning in your sleep lately. I can tell something wasn't right.
down. Oh, yeah. No, yeah. No. What's on your mind? Don't you keep on telling me everything's okay? 'Cause if it wasn't, you wouldn't be crying. You've been tossing and turning in your sleep lately, just sitting around pouting all day long. Or when I don't even know what's wrong. Let's straighten it out, baby. I wanna straighten it out. Hey, hey, hey. But when you turn your back to me and you covered your head, oh, you didn't even say goodnight. Now if you're tired and you don't want to be bothered, baby, just say the word and I'll leave you alone. Now, instead of laying that cry in your eyes, oh, baby, you and me ought to be getting it on. Let's straighten it out. Baby, I want to straighten it out. Hey, hey, baby, I want to straighten it out. Yeah, 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 baby, I want to straighten it out. Hey, hey, yeah, 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 straighten it out. That's all I want to do. That's all I want to do. Baby, I want to straighten. Straight.
waiting it out. That's all I wanna do. That's all I wanna do, baby. I wanna straighten it out. You know, everybody's gotta straighten out something sometime. I don't care how old you are, how young you are. I don't care if you're married, single, divorced, engaged, or shackled. You gotta straighten out something every now and then. But I want you to think about all the times that you've heard somebody say, let's straighten it out, think about it. And I guarantee you that it was a man who said it. I know it got real quiet that time. The reason why I say that most of the time it's a man who says, let's straighten it out, more than let's face it, most of the time it's a man who makes it crooked in the first place. We don't mean no harm now. It's just a way where sometimes we just have a tendency to sort of take you ladies for granted, don't we? Always acting like we don't understand something. But I believe a woman feels things deeper than a man. I don't care what nobody says. I believe a woman loves stronger than a man. Don't get the wrong idea. Go telling nobody Lattimore is coming down on the man. I'm a man myself. I just happen to learn a few things. So don't y'all let me lie out here. You see, the reason I say that is that I believe a woman don't like to be jiving around when she's making love. Some men don't like me to be talking like that on the stage, see. But I don't care. I ain't gonna do nothing but tell the truth. If you can't stand the truth, you ain't got no business in your bed, in your house, anywhere, nowhere around you. If you can't stand the truth, just put it out and get yourself a qualified man. Then you ain't got to worry about it. All you gotta do. Straighten it out all night long. All night long. You gotta straighten it out.
Oh, after some blues, let us listen to some calypso. David Rutter out of Trinidad and Tobago. And I met David Rutter on the streets of Toronto, Canada. He was lost. And we were on the streets of Toronto. He wanted to go to a place called, he was on Sherbourne. And he wanted to go to an apartment building. And I took David Rutter to where he wanted to go. And I don't think he would be like Dionne Warwick. Do you know the way to San Jose? He just didn't know his way to, he didn't know Sherbourne Street in Toronto. But David Rutter did a nice song, a relevant song called Haiti, and it's relevant in this period of history. It was relevant, and it will be relevant until Haiti and all of Africa is free, and even after that, it will be relevant. The song is called Haiti. It's by David Rutter.
Tu sei was a mighty man, a
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali. And Dr. Gerald Horn has a new book out called Confronting Black Jacobins, the United States, the Haitian Revolution, the Origins of the Dominican Republic. he delivered a speech in New York City explaining the book and the issues of today, and we wanted to present Dr. Gerald Horn speaking at the New York University. And let us present Dr. Gerald Horn speaking on confronting Black Jacobins, the United States, the Haitian Revolution, and the origins of the Dominican Republic.
Well, thank you very much for the introduction. Thank you all for coming. Thanks to NYU, this wonderful archive, which I have visited numerous occasions in the past. And it's always a pleasure to be here because it's just a treasure trove and a cornucopia of information, documentation, etc. It's a jewel, and I recommend it highly. And of course, thanks to all of you for coming. About a year ago, I was at a conference of historians at the CUNY Graduate Center in Manhattan, a stone's throw from here. And the conference was on U.S. slavery and abolition. And during the course of the proceedings, one of the members of the audience asked one of the historians, would the historian care to tease out some of the contemporary ramifications and repercussions of this intriguing historical discussion that was taking place? And as the historical luminaries on the platform nodded sagely, the historian responded that he was trained not to tease out the contemporary ramifications and repercussions of historical events. And I was thinking to myself at the time, well, then what's the point studying history? I mean, is this some sort of antiquarian enterprise? And one of the things I would like to stress to you this evening is that I think it's mandatory to tease out the contemporary ramifications and repercussions of historical events. And I say this particularly standing here in New York and in the United States of America, where there's an ongoing crisis. So we obviously need deeper thinking, not least on this spate of televised, almost pornographic murders and violence that is becoming too much a part of our daily diet. Of course, I'm speaking of Eric Garner in the first place, who was killed right here in the city, but of course, Freddie Gray and Sandra Bland, the most recent outrage from Columbia, South Carolina, where the black girl is flipped over and assaulted by a police officer, apparently just for using her telephone class. So the criminalizing of a teenage energy, in a sense. And of course, you might recall that that had been preceded by another episode in Texas, where another black girl was wrestled to the ground by a police officer. She had a bathing suit on, so you couldn't say that she had a weapon or of some sort. The Michael Brown case, the Trayvon Martin case. Obviously, we need deeper thinking with regard to what's going on, and also with regard to some of the lethargic, if not hostile, attitudes towards those who are raising their voices. I'm speaking of these defaming and slanderous attacks on the Black Lives Matter movement from some of the more eminent and prominent voices in the United States of America. And I think that part of what I'm going to be talking about this evening hopefully will help to shed light on why these outrages persist. That is to say, hopefully you'll get a glimpse of the roots of this Afrophobia, what used to be called Negrophobia. And I should also say that I'm working on this project on South Africa now, and it's relevant to this enterprise because, as the introduction noted, I'm suggesting that in order to understand the abolition of slavery, it's mandatory to go beyond the four corners of the United States of America. I think that's one of the defects of a lot of contemporary historiography on slavery, is that it treats it solely as an internal matter, both its rise and devolution, when actually, of course, it's part of an international system. Any school child in South Africa, for example, could tell you that, of course, the events on the ground at the southern tip of Africa were, needless to say, hugely important in terms of the retreat of apartheid. But we all know about the Cuban troops and their historic victory over the apartheid army in southern Angola in 1988, and the rumor that was then floated that they were going to march to Pretoria and forcibly oust the apartheid leaders from power, which helped to make them, that is to say, the apartheid leaders, negotiate more reasonably, more judiciously. It helped to deliver a kind of sweet reason to their otherwise deformed brains. We all know about the fact that the Mkhonto Wesizwe, the African National Congress armed wing started by Nelson Mandela, mostly trained in Angola and East Germany, Soviet Union. We all know that when Oliver Tambo, the then leader of the ANC, fell ill, as negotiations were just being launched with the apartheid regime, that he was treated in Scandinavia. We all know about the divestment movement in the United States of America and its impact in terms of the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act circa 1986, and how that too sounded the death knell for apartheid. So certainly, if you're going to talk about the apartheid decline and devolution and the coming of African majority rule, you have to talk about it in an international context. And likewise, if you talk about slavery in the United States and its decline, its ultimate collapse, it simply won't do just to talk about it within the four corners of the United States of America. You have to talk about it in a global context, and you have to talk about it in terms not only of British abolition, which was several orders of magnitude stronger than abolition in the United States, but you also have to talk about the Haitian Revolution and the crisis that it ignited in the slave system, which could only be resolved with its collapse. And of course, even non-radical historians in the United States today acknowledge that when you talk about the retreat of Jim Crow in the 1950s and the 1960s, it was not solely a product of the rulers in the United States coming to their senses because of the marching feet in Birmingham and Selma and elsewhere. It was also because there was a global crisis. There was a Cold War going on, with Washington seeking to point the finger of accusation for human rights violations, real and imagined, at the socialist camp. And that created a dynamic, as even the State Department and the United States Supreme Court acknowledged, that led to a process that caused apartheid to retreat. And of course, a footnote to that analysis is that you may want to consider today what are the international forces that could cause a similar impact upon these United States of America. And in that context, I have to say that I was a tad disappointed a few weeks ago when most of the leaders of the world came to New York City, Xi Jinping of China, Putin of Russia, Raul Castro, Mugabe, etc. And I didn't see the kinds of mass demonstrations that I expected about this crisis in the United States, despite the fact that I've been made to understand that we're in a state of emergency, which I think is a fair assessment, with regard to police violence. And we may want to discuss the disconnect between that passionate rhetoric and an apparent inability to contemplate the lessons of the past, that is to say, the import and the impact of global trends and international currents in our domestic situation. And this is particularly important when we talk about the abolition of slavery, because it's fair to say that many of the current malignancies that we face in this country have their roots in the fact that the United States had its origins as a slaveholder's republic, and in fact, that the colonizing process that overwhelmed the indigenous population of North America, particularly in the 17th century, was deeply inflected and impacted by slavery. And yet, when you talk about the abolition of slavery, I have before me this new volume in Atlantic History that has been produced by some of the leading scholars in the United States, if not globally, and this Princeton Companion to Atlantic History, which is the title, has a section on abolition written by a leading scholar of abolition, and he talks about abolition without reference to the Haitian Revolution and basically lays the responsibility or the credit, if you like, for this world historic process at the doorstep of Londoners in many senses, and without even explaining why Londoners in the late 18th century and the early 19th century might have been seized by a passion for abolition. And in some ways, what it does, it makes our allies, because certainly Wilberforce was an ally, it makes the allies the stars of the show, and the actual grave diggers of slavery on Hispaniola as either bit players or absent. And we really need to think about how that can be written. Of course, there's a cliche from rock music criticism that most rock critics like Elvis Costello because most rock critics look like Elvis Costello. And there may be something of that at play in the sense that these writers today, they find it much more simple and they find it easier to identify with Wilberforce than to identify with these Africans in Hispaniola or even on the North American mainland who were the actual grave diggers of the slave system and helped to ignite this process that ultimately was a huge and monumental gain for working people everywhere. Because slavery, as I'm sure you recognize, was a drag on the wages and working conditions of working people globally, whether they were slaves or not. And when slavery is abolished, that's a great leap forward for the working class globally. And I think that part of the problem might be that even from some of our friends on the left, they have difficulty in constructing the struggle against slavery as a class struggle, among other things. Perhaps they're blinded by the light, they're blinded by the white, but in any case, it has led, I think, to a kind of myopia, if you like, a kind of short-sightedness with regard to the staggering importance of the Haitian Revolution in the first place. Now, this book, in many ways, is a sequel to my book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, a book which seeks to shed light on a question that should be asked. That is to say, many historians have spent quality time asking, why is there no socialism in the United States? I think that that's an important question, but we also need to ask, why is conservatism so strong in the United States?
Yes. Mm.
And I think that there are some non sequiturs at play that even our friends on the left subscribe to. In other words, there was this grand revolution in North America, which led, ironically enough, to an increase in slavery, in the number of slaves in the United States, which led to the United States, the newly born republic, displacing the Spanish as early as the 1790s as the major carriers of Africans to Cuba, which led the United States by the 1830s and the 1840s to be the major supplier of Africans to Brazil. And of course, my book over there, Race to Revolution on Cuba, talks about the Cuban aspect, and my NYU Press book on Brazil talks about Brazilian presses. And in some ways, even our friends on the left have subscribed to what might sardonically and sarcastically be characterized as a kind of perverted New Yorker cartoon, where the black person in the cartoon says, the great news is I've been part of an important leap forward for humanity. The bad news is that I'm a slave. Now, of course, that makes no sense. I mean, our friends on the left even find it difficult to acknowledge what historians before myself acknowledged, which is that the Africans, by far in North America, did not side with the rebels led by George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and slave owners. They sided with the rebels' opponents, just like if you look at the Boer War, in South Africa, as it's called, the Boer-British War, 1899 to 1902, many of our friends on the left, of course, supported the Boers, I guess on the premise that this would be a defeat inflicted on the British Empire. Mm-hmm. That was not the view of black people either in South Africa or in the United States of America. I mean, we really need to bridge this gap, this yawning gap that exists between some of our friends on the left and many of the advanced thinking processes in the black community, both in North America and globally, because I think we really need to understand, if we want to understand why the right wing has been so powerful in this country, we're going to have to break with some of our old ways of thinking and start looking at new evidence and new insights. Otherwise, I think we'll have plenty of time to discuss these issues as we're all interned in Yankee Stadium at some point in the 21st century on spurious political grounds. Now, 1776 led, as noted, to a victory for slave owners and slave traders. The rebels were supported by the French. You might know that the pivotal Battle of Yorktown, a significant percentage of the soldiers with the victorious rebels, of course, were of French origin. However, the French had to borrow heavily in order to inflict this defeat upon their antagonists across the channel, speaking of Britain. This helps to ignite a process in France that eventuates in the French Revolution. You should also know that as part of this process of closer relations between the infant United States and France, U.S. slave traders, as was their wont, were manacling and handcuffing Africans with the maniacal energy of crazed bees, dragging them across the Atlantic to the island of Hispaniola, and increasing tremendously and exponentially the enslaved population on the island of Hispaniola, to the point where in certain precincts, the Africans outnumbered the Europeans at some points by a ratio of 30 to 1. This creates a combustible brew whereby Africans are being cruelly and exploited and plundered at the time when their numbers were growing tremendously, and a time when many of them were fresh from Africa and had not been acclimated, if you like, to the kinds of conditions they would face in the Americas, this creates kindling for an eruption of what comes to be called the Haitian Revolution, that is to say in August 1791. And by the way, of course, as some of you may know, there were also Jamaicans present at the creation of August 1791, a point that will become relevant rather shortly. What happens, of course, is that rather quickly, the Africans on the island Hispaniola gain a good deal of traction, which outrages and infuriates the Slovocracy globally, not only in the United States of America, but of course in the major empires, that is to say, London and Spain in the first place. Londoners, that is to say, Britain intervenes with a heavy hand in the late 1790s and suffers one of the most significant and ignominious defeats in British imperial history. And this has significant impact because with that defeat in Haiti, Britain begins to suspect, justifiably and understandably, that their holdings in nearby Jamaica, not to mention in Barbados, St. Kitts, and the other islands, might be in jeopardy because, like revolutionaries anywhere, the Haitian revolutionaries were interested in spreading their radical gospel. And as noted a moment ago, there were Jamaicans involved in this revolutionary process virtually from day one. So this helps to induce a certain kind of sober realism in London elite circles, helping to plant the seeds that allows abolitionism to flower, hence the rise of Wilberforce, Clarkson, and all the rest. Not only that, but as you probably know, there were significant conflicts and contradictions between London and its former colony, that is to say, the nation, United States of America, and it did not require a genius or oracle to realize that London concedes the moral high ground by moving towards the abolition of the slave trade, 1807, and then the abolition of slavery itself, 1833-1834, and put pressure on this United States of America, which had this model of development, the brutalization and enslavement of Africans. Now, admittedly, it was possible for London to move in that direction because there were, in Britain, they were not as dependent upon slave labor on the banks of the Thames as they were on the banks of the Potomac. Not only that, but the London elite had good reason to believe that the Caribbean planter class may have been more sympathetic to the United States of America and had dreams of 1776 all their own, and might have wanted to have a kind of secessionist process that would have them incorporated into the United States of America. Of course, we talk about the 13 colonies seceding in 1776, but we should also be asking, well, you know, there were other British possessions in the Americas. Why didn't they secede? And what kept them from seceding in 1776? And was it inevitable that that lack of secession would continue indefinitely? So with the rise of the Haitian revolutionaries, you also see a split in the first instance, in the early stages, in the U.S. ruling elite. Many in New England who were dependent upon shipping and were more keen to see France ousted altogether from the hemisphere were more sympathetic to assisting the revolutionaries against Paris, which of course was considered to be dangerous, if not nonsensical, by many in the planter class, because the planter class had good reason to believe that the Haitian revolutionaries would not only threaten Jamaica, they could also threaten Dixie itself. And there had been stories to that effect throughout the 1790s and the early 1800s. In any case, the revolutionaries' triumph, circa January 1st, 1804, the regime in Haiti is not recognized by the United States until 1862, when, of course, the United States was on the ropes because of the traitorous secessionists and the so-called Confederate States of America. And, of course, the United States had reason to think that the so-called CSA, so-called Confederate States of America, might get international support. And of course, one of the places where it was well recognized that the CSA would receive no kind of hearing was, of course, Haiti. That's when the United States found out who its true friends were. And that led to the recognition of Haiti after 58 years of non-recognition. By way of comparison, the Cuban Revolution triumphed in 1959, and it took until, let's say, 2014 for that regime to be acknowledged by Washington. So let's see, 41 plus 15. So that's 56 years. So
China a good while
too. So in a sense, there's been progress, as you can say, with regard to recognizing regimes, revolutionary regimes in the hemisphere. But in any case, with the triumph of the Haitian Revolution, January 1st, 1804, you need to recognize that the revolutionaries only controlled the western side of the island, with present-day Haiti. The eastern side of the island was still controlled by Spain. So what happens in the early 1820s, as Spain is on the ropes, seemingly a perpetual status for that once-proud nation, the Haitian military marches into the eastern side of the island and takes over and immediately abolishes slavery. You may recall that Spain did not abolish slavery in Cuba until the 1880s. And of course, it was eventually ousted, as you know, by the United States, circa 1898. After the Haitians take over the eastern side of the island, they have reason to think that some who in the future would be called Dominicans might not necessarily be sympathetic to their project, so they begin to accelerate a process that had characterized the Haitian Revolution ever since the triumph of that republic in January 1804. That is to say, they began to reach out to what was then called the U.S. Negro population, particularly the so-called free Negro population. And it's estimated that about 13,000 U.S. Free Negroes migrated to Haiti in the 1820s, moving to the eastern side of the island to bolster Haitian revolutionary rule on the island. And this becomes important when, in 1844, as Haiti is going through a spate of turmoil induced not least by the kind of strangling processes inflicted on the island because of the pressure, incessant pressure from the United States and its allies that caused the regime to spend a disproportionate amount of the national budget and national income on the military as opposed to education, health care, and the people's needs. Process that you may be familiar with in the United States of America, I'm sure. And this leads, of course, to a secession of what is now the Dominican Republic in 1844. This leads to fierce and protracted struggle between Haiti and what is now the Dominican Republic. As I try to suggest in this book, you may be able to characterize I think you will be able to characterize the secession of the Dominican Republic in 1844 as one of the first successful covert actions by the United States, because the evidence that I bring forward suggests that the hawkish South Carolinian, John C. Calhoun, then Secretary of State, helped to fund and promote this secession, leading to the splitting off of the DR, leading to protracted struggle between Haiti and the DR that, as you know, continues to this very day. Mm-hmm. A protracted struggle that was heavily colored, if you like, by color phobia and by racism, something living in New York I'm sure you're not unfamiliar with. And it leads to the rather paradoxical consequence, circa 1860, when in a remarkable maneuver, the Dominican government asked Spain to come back and recolonize the DR. I mean, usually countries resist colonization, not invite it. But this was a reflection of the rather strong and pungent hysteria that existed in the DR about Haiti, a hysteria that arguably exists to this very day, although it's important to acknowledge that many Dominicans opposed this recolonization process by Spain, that they joined hand with the Haitians to drive out the colonizers as the U.S. Civil War was unfolding in the 1860s. And I should insert a major parenthesis here that I hope should be implicit, and if not, I'll make it explicit, which is that I respect Dominican sovereignty. I would not like to cast any aspersions on the government of Santo Domingo, which I respect, and I respect its territorial integrity and its sovereignty. However, I do think it's important to bring out this history in order to understand what's going on in October 2015 with this rather gruesome expulsion of many Dominican nationals who have been somehow reconstructed as being Haitian. There was even an article in the New York Times, if I'm not mistaken, this morning about this process. And it's a major human rights violation. It led to the leading Dominican writer, Junot Diaz, castigating his government in Santo Domingo, which in turn rebuked and reprimanded him in no uncertain terms. But I dare say that this crisis, we've not heard the last of this crisis, and so therefore I think it's important to try to bring as much historical understanding to these terrible contemporary events as we can. In any case,
Nanga Def is Wolof. It is spoken in Senegal, the Gambia, and parts of Mauritania. And Nanga Def is a greeting in Wolof, like I said. And I believe Jetty Jeff is thank you in Wolof. But we were listening to Dr. Gerald Horn. He is speaking about the Haitian Revolution and the origins of the Dominican Republic. And that was part one. And we're going to listen to the second part after we pay tribute to Nina Simone. We're going to pay tribute to Nina Simone, whose birthday was on February the 21st, which is Martyrs' Day. February the 21st is the day that El Hajj Malik Shabazz was born in 1925, and it was the day that El Hajj Malik was slain, was killed, murdered on February the 1st in 1965 at the Audubon Ballroom in New York City. It was also the day that Nina Simone was born a year later. And, pardon me, she was born on February 21st in the 30s. Pardon me. But we pay tribute to Nina Simone because Nina Simone made a contribution to the liberation of all oppressed people, women, men from the African continent. Nina Simone lived in Barbados. She lived in Liberia. She lived in Switzerland. She lived in Paris. And, of course, she grew up in North Carolina. But we're going to listen to Nina Simone.
Bind us apart. to be me. You'd see, you'd agree, everybody should be free, cause if we ain't, we're murderous. Wish I could be like a bird in the sky. How sweet it would be. It's moving now. I know, got news for you, I already know. Jonathan Livingston Seagull ain't got nothing on me.
Uhuru, you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We just got through listening to Nina Simone. I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. And that was a song that was played at the funeral of George Jackson. And that was one of Nina's foundation songs. And Nina Simone's music has been recorded by a lot of other people. I saw Michelle Indigocello at UCLA in a couple of years ago, maybe a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. And she did a whole tribute. She has an album, a tribute album to Nina Simone. We wanted to look into Michelle Indigocello, a great musician on her own. And she's going to do Nina Simone. Please Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood. And also we're going to hear the original or the first version, the Nina Simone's rendition of Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood. And this was not an original from Nina Simone. This was, I believe it was done by Eric Burton Ward at first. But nevertheless, it's a great song. It has a great message. And Michelle Indigocello and Nina Simone.
Mm-hmm. misunderstood.
Sometimes you see that I'm mad. Don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. Sometimes, baby, I'm so carefree, with a joy that's hard to hide. And then sometimes again it seems that all I have is worry. And then you're bound to see my other side. But I'm just a soul. I get more than my share, but that's one thing I never mean to do, 'cause I love you. Oh, oh, baby, I'm just human. Don't you know I have faults like anyone? Sometimes I find myself alone regretting some little foolish thing, some simple thing that I've done. 'Cause I so hard, so please don't let me be.
Habari gani to all of our listeners from Swahili in Tanzania, Kenya, Uganda, parts of the Congo. Now, habari gani is Swahili. And we're going to continue our trip to Nina Simone. I saw Nina Simone two times, once in Detroit and once in Toronto, Canada. And Nina Simone was quite a show person, and she recorded a song which we're going to play at soon for women, and I was out with a sister from Detroit that I had recently met. And I was in the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and she was close to the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. So we went to see Nina Simone, and Nina Simone started singing for women. And she started calling out the men that had mistreated the women. And the woman that I was with, she stood up and started hollering and screaming, testifying. And you know, everybody was looking at me like... I was the man who had done all of that, but I had recently met this sister, and we laugh about that all the time now, but it's a funny thing. You know, Simone did Young, Gifted, and Black, and she was influenced by Lorraine Hansberry. Lorraine Hansberry was the poet, and she wrote a play called Young, Gifted, and Black, and she she was friends with Nina Simone, and Nina Simone, her, Nina Simone, Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael, or Godfrey Cambridge being from Guyana, he had Guyanese roots, and Nina talks about how her and Lorraine Hansberry used to talk about little girls' things like Marx and Lenin, and Nina was a serious political person. She was, she talked about class, race, and gender. And we're also going to be playing a song called Mississippi Goddamn. So let's listen to Nina Simone, Young, Gifted, and Black, Mississippi Goddamn, and Four Women, Nina Simone.
To be young, gifted, and black. Oh, what a lovely, precious dream. To be young, gifted, and black. Open your heart to what I mean. In the whole
So upset, and Tennessee has made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi. God damn. Hound dogs on my trail. School children sitting in jail. Black cat crossed my path. I think every day's gonna be my last. Lord have mercy on this land of mine. We all gonna get it in due time. I don't belong here. I don't belong there. I've even stopped believing in prayer. Don't tell me, I'll tell you, me and my people just about do. I've been there, so I know. They keep on saying, go slow. That's what they say, go slow. That's what they say, go slow. That's what's the trouble.
Go slow.
Washing the windows.
Slow.
Picking the cotton.
Slow.
With nothing but rotten.
Slow.
Too damn lazy.
No.
I'm thinking it's crazy.
No.
Where am I going? What am I doing? I don't know. I don't know. Just try to do your very best. Stand up, be counted with all the rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi. God damn. School boycotts. They try to say it's a communist plot, but all I want is equality for my sister, my brother, my people, and me. My people and me. You lied to me all these years. You told me to wash and clean my ears and talk real fine, just like a lady. You'd stop calling me Sister Sadie. But my country's full of lies. We all gonna die and die like flies. 'Cause I don't trust.
trust nobody anymore. They keep on saying, go slow. Yeah, that's what they say, go slow. Well, that's just the trouble. Desegregation, mass participation, unification, do things gradually, will bring more tragedy. Why don't you see it? Why don't you feel it? I don't know, I don't know. You don't have to live next to me, just give me my equality.
Hello.
Sweet thing, and I said,
much too rough in this hot sun. It's been too rough. I'm awfully bitter these days because the only parents I know were slaves. What do they call me?
Nanga Def, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the not-so-great white north here in Toronto, Canada. And we're going to conclude Dr. Jerry Horn's speech at the New York, and he is speaking about his book, Confronting Black Jacobins, the United States, the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Republic. And check this out.
In any case, because of the strategic assistance of the Haitians, which allowed Union, that is to say United States ships, to have access to Haitian ports, the United States was able to beat back the secessionist escapades of the so-called Confederate States of America. But as that process was unfolding, some very disturbing signals were being emitted. What I mean is that as early as 1844, when the United States helped to engineer the secession of the Dominican Republic, it was already common knowledge that there were those in the United States of America who, as I said, had a terrible slave trading Jones, who wanted to go into Haiti and kidnap Haitians and bring them back to Dixie to work in the cotton fields. Of course, it's easier to get to Haiti than to West Africa, or certainly East Africa, where most of the Africans came from, which of course causes Haiti to engage in many defensive maneuvers to prevent the process of being re-enslaved. And then of course this process of trying to re-enslave Haitians accelerates like a rocket during the U.S. Civil War. With so-called slave ships from the Confederate States of America coming into Haitian waters and trying to kidnap Haitians and drag them into Dixie. This was just a prelude to what happens after the U.S. Civil War concludes, when the United States, after defeating the so-called Confederate States of America, decides that the better part of wisdom would be to annex not only the Dominican Republic, but as the hidden agenda, Haiti too, and deport a significant percentage of the newly freed U.S. Negro slaves to the island. We need a comprehensive text, and I say this to the younger people in the audience in particular, a comprehensive text about the repeated efforts to deport the black population of the United States of America. A proposition that seems to come into being repeatedly. You know, of course, the same that Abraham Lincoln negotiated with the Brazilians to send the newly freed enslaved Africans there. He was negotiating with the Ecuadorians. Problem is, nobody wanted to take us, for better or for worse. And interestingly enough, with regard to the failed project of annexing the island, it went to Congress and was barely defeated. To his everlasting credit, Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts was a staunch opponent of this harebrained scheme. And interestingly enough, the great Frederick Douglass, who I respect as I detail in the book, was on the opposite side of the fence. Although, to conclude, Frederick Douglass, of course, was one of the first individuals to sense the world historic importance of the Haitian Revolution, which was not only a significant blow against slavery in the Americas, igniting a general crisis in the entire slave system that could only be resolved with its collapse, but also was a significant blow in favor of people who are compelled to sell their labor for a wage. Once again, because slavery serves as a drag on the wages and working conditions of working class people generally. Unfortunately, the travails of poor Haiti did not conclude with the failed attempt of annexation, 1870-1871, although roughly that's where my book concludes. You know, I'm sure, about the U.S. occupation of both Haiti and the DR as World War I is unfolding. The centennial is being marked. We all know, of course, about the support from Washington of the Duvalier kleptocracy, which looted and plundered Haiti for oh so many years. We all know, of course, about the tragedy of the 2010 earthquake and how so many of us contributed our last dime to the U.S. Red Cross, which then pledged to build homes for the Haitians, homes that we're still waiting for, although apparently those millions of dollars that were collected somehow have disappeared into the ether. We all know about the misdeeds of the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation, headquartered in your own New York City, which also, shall we say, has a certain amount of culpability, if you like, for the tragedy that has unfolded in Haiti since the earthquake of January 2010. And even as we speak, you know, I'm sure, about the fact that elections were held in Haiti just days ago. Apparently, they've adopted the Florida model of counting votes because it's still not clear what the results are. And from my understanding, ballot boxes were stuffed, votes are disappearing, and I'm still waiting for an outcry from the U.S. State Department, although I'm not going to hold my breath until I hear it.
Always a good practice.
In any case, my friends, let me conclude by saying that we all owe an enormous debt of gratitude to our brothers and sisters in Haiti who sacrificed so much. They were on the front lines taking the arrows in their chests on our behalf. We all know that if you look at the major slave revolts that hit the North American mainland, Gabriel circa 1800 in Virginia, Denmark Vesey circa 1821 in South Carolina, Nat Turner circa 1831 in Virginia, they all have Haitian fingerprints all over them. And you can say the same thing for most of the tremendous slave revolts that hit, say, Barbados in 1816, and the ones that hit Jamaica in the run-up to abolition in the 1830s. We all owe an enormous debt of gratitude to the Haitians that I doubt if ever can be repaid. And therefore, let me conclude with an appeal for solidarity with our struggling Haitian brothers and sisters who need us because they were there when we needed them. Thank you very much. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, Joe, excellent presentation. I want to go over the struggles of recolonization schemes that have gone through, the question of assimilation and recolonization or colonization schemes of, you know, transporting blacks to other parts, to Africa or to the Caribbean, and the question of
Well, I'll mention a few points, and you may want to chime in too to enlighten those assembled. I mean, I think the current scholarship suggests that there were certain kinds of colonization of the U.S. Negroes, and we're talking mostly about the free Negro population, to be clear, were in favor of, such as going to Haiti. Then the so-called American Colonization Society, which had in its leadership many of the leading bigots in North America, were in favor of sending the free Negro population as far away from North America as they could send them, particularly to Liberia. And of course, Liberia, this West African nation, in many ways is a tragedy all of its own, insofar as the so-called Americo-Liberia population, which begins to travel there approximately 200 years ago, in many ways establish a kind of apartheid system where they're lording it over the indigenous African population, which, as you may recall, leads to an explosion in Liberia approximately 1980 with the rise of Master Sergeant Samuel Doe and the coup that overthrows the government. I think you can still find on YouTube the massacres of many of the Americo-Liberia elite as they take them to the beach and just sort of mow them down. And that helps to ignite this bloody process in Liberia that, of course, leads to this process of blood diamonds and child soldiers and the other kinds of outrages that have been too frequent, not only in Liberia, but in Sierra Leone itself. Let me take this opportunity, since I have an audience here, to mention a couple of other points. Speaking of Sierra Leone made me think of a TV show that I highly recommend, The Book of Negroes. Anybody see The Book of Negroes? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Check out The Book of Negroes. You can find it on Netflix. And it's illustrative of some of the points that I was making. What do I mean by that?
It's also a book.
Yes. What do I mean by that? What I mean is, this is a Canadian South African BET production.
Oh, yeah, I think I saw that.
It shows on BET, the Black Entertainment Television Network of the United States of America. It's sort of roots in the sense that in the 18th century, the lead character is kidnapped from West Africa, brought to the Carolinas, winds up migrating to New York City. New York figures in the plot. But she finds her freedom by leaving the United States and going to Sierra Leone and to London. But what's striking is that the Canadians and the South Africans, unlike some of our friends on the left, have little problem in understanding that the Negroes weren't down with this revolt against British rule. And a classic of some takes place when the lead character, this black woman, confronts George Washington as he is about to become triumphant and the British are about to leave.
Yeah.
That was a classic scene. But the reason I mention that is because, once again, it's one of the few, what I can say, accurate portrayals of 1776, not like Mel Gibson's
The Patriot,
which is totally incoherent, as it tries to explain. He should have consulted with some of our U.S. left friends. They would have been able to explain why slavery, supporting slave owners, as slave owners wanted to expand slavery. They could have made him a lot of money as consultants to explain that incoherent nonsense. Yes.
Hi. Thank you so much, Dr. Horn. This was really, really informative. I have two questions. One's really short. I just wanted to know if you know what the African heritage of Haitians could have possibly been. Is there any way to trace that? Or that's my first question. And my second question is, oh my gosh, I totally lost my train of thought. Sorry, someone else asked me a question.
Well, I'll start talking and then you can interrupt.
Okay, perfect.
I would think that given the fact that the disproportionate percentage of the Africans in Hispaniola were brought to the island between 1776 and 1791, and given, as already noted, the collaboration between the United States and France, that the roots of black people in Haiti are most likely disproportionately found in territories where France had influence, such as Senegal, for example. and other parts of West Africa where France had influence. Now, with regard to the United States, I've done a fair amount of study about U.S. slave trading, and you should know that the U.S. slave traders were all over Africa.
That's right.
As early as the 1840s, they were the major economic force in Zanzibar, the island off the coast of Southeast Africa, which is now part of Tanzania, which was a kind of Kmart of the slave trade. Because, of course, even before the rise of the Atlantic slave trade, you had a slave trade that was hitting East Africa, heading eastward, and Zanzibar was a key node in that process. The U.S. slave traders, of course, collaborated heavily with the Portuguese in Angola and in Mozambique. And in fact, if you look at Stono's Revolt, the bloodiest revolt in colonial North American history, South Carolina, circa 1739, a disproportionate percentage of those Africans who revolted were Angolan. And many of them spoke Portuguese, many of them were Catholic. And of course, were on the way to marching towards Spanish Florida as they were massacred by the settlers. So, given that relationship, I would also suspect that a significant percentage of the black folks in Haiti have roots in Angola as well. What was your follow-up?
Yes, I remember my other question. So I recently found out that the Haitian Revolution was really instrumental in the French and Indian War, and that success sort of it was really sort of vital to the U.S.'s success in the French Indian War. So I wanted to know if you knew any details about that.
Well, in my 1776 book, I deal with that 1756 to 1763 conflict, which I posit is one of the turning points in North American history and black history, because the British basically have what is called a catastrophic success. That is to say that they triumph over the French, and of course they are able to oust them from Quebec, leaving in Canada this national question of the Quebecois, which is still nagging to this very day. But in order to achieve this grand victory, they feel compelled, that is to say, London feels compelled to impose more taxes on the settlers for whom this war was fought. And because to relieve pressure from the so-called Catholic powers, France in the first place, and when the taxes are imposed on the settlers, well, you all know the rest of the story, because that's the ABCs of the traditional narrative of 1776. Taxation without representation. Of course, these interesting about this taxation question, and here's another topic for a younger scholar. I mean, with this anti-tax mania in the United States, where people, a good deal of people in this country, I'm not going to say who they are, they apparently want services. They don't want to pay taxes. And it's interesting, I think, that that might be characteristic of a slave society.
Yeah.
Where you get people to work for free. And so perhaps they've grown all too acclimated and accustomed to getting stuff for free. Which is why they don't want any time. I mean, that's just one more hypothesis about the nonsense that passes for politics and the so-called republic. Yes?
Yeah. In terms of challenging the traditional narrative about the origins of what I call the American War of Independence, because it wasn't a revolution, there's a book called Slave Nation by the Blumrosens that basically says that in the early 1770s, there was a legal decision in England called the Somerset decision, and I think it's referred to in the Book of Negroes, but I forget, that basically challenges the legality of slavery in England, which then instills fear in the slave holders and owners of the colonies, which then unites them in the fight for independence. So, you know, I taught social studies for 20 years in high school, And I would say that I would have been on the side of the British as a way to get some controversy going, because basically, you know, the War of Independence, what united both the North and the South was in fact a fear and an opposition that what happened in England would spread to the to their rule in the colonies. Now, I'm wondering what your what you have to say about that.
Well, Somerset's case figures heavily in my 1776 book. June 1772, when... Oh, anybody see Bell?
Yeah.
Not yet.
Yep. So check out Bell, too. It's another film that is directed by a sister, a black woman with Ghanaian roots who resides in London and Amsterdam. And, yeah, it's very interesting. It deals with Lord Mansfield in the run-up to the Somerset's case, which, as you correctly suggest, basically abolishes slavery in England, and there's a fear that that decision will cross the Atlantic, thereby jeopardizing fortunes in Virginia in particular, which helps to ignite unrest that eventuates in kicking the British out, which is one of the reasons why I analogize 1776 to UDI in Rhodesia, Unilateral Declaration of Independence in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, November 1965. You may recall that the so-called white minority regime there rebels against London because they think London is moving towards African majority rule. And rather than accede to that decision, they rebel and kick out the British. And as a matter of fact, Ian Smith, the leader of that outlaw regime, openly confesses and concedes that he's walking in the footsteps of 1776. Now, there's another point, too, that I'd like to get on the table, which is the split between North and South. I mean, on the one hand, a case can be made that the South has taken too much of the burden in terms of racism and slavery, particularly when one considers that the slave trade itself, of course, it was headquartered in a place like New York. I mean, New York was the center of the financing of the slave trade to a large degree, and of course, Newport, Rhode Island, Boston, etc. But on the other hand, you don't want to let the salt off the hook, since we know that some of the, if you look at the United States politics today, it's no accident, as the historians like to say, that some of the most backward and retrograde elements are in the 11 states of the old Confederacy, stretching from Virginia to Texas, particularly Texas and Louisiana. We all know that in 1991, as the Soviet Union is decomposing, that 60% of the Euro-American population in Louisiana vote for a card-carrying Nazi and Klansman, David Duke, to be governed. Only a tremendous turnout by the black vote keeps the fascists from being elected governor of Louisiana in December 1961. You know, interestingly enough, to take another punch at some of our friends on the left, some of our friends on the left, they tell me that their purpose in life is to fight fascism. I haven't seen any sort of analysis of December 1991 in Louisiana. I'm not even sure if they know about it, which makes me cast doubt, if not aspersions, on their bona fides. So this whole question that we face in the United States of America in terms of this so-called regional divide between North and South, I think it needs a fair amount of scrutiny and interrogation, because a case can be made for both sides, as I've just articulated.
If I could add just one other thing, my favorite quote that not enough people know about, Lafayette, Marquis de Lafayette, who George Washington took under his wing and considered him to be a close friend, et cetera, et cetera. Whenever I see a statue of Lafayette, I think the words should be engraved of what Lafayette eventually said to Washington, which is that if I would have known that I lifted my sword in the cause of slavery, I never would have lifted my sword.
Well, interesting, on page 33 of this new book, I talk about Jean-Baptiste Dussop, who of course is given credit for founding the city of Chicago. And I go on to say, it was also not without irony that as this town was being founded, the famed Marquis de Lafayette, still celebrated on the mainland, was happily telling Benjamin Franklin that Senegal had been, quote, taken by our troops, unquote, in West Africa. It was, quote, previously in the enemy's hands, unquote, and this, he noted, was preventing the Negro trade, which had been benefiting the, quote, southern gentlemen of America, unquote. Thus, he concluded, I believe our conquest will be pleasing to them. Any other? Yes.
As many historians have studied the Haitian Revolution, General Henri Christophe, who was one of the leading generals of the Revolution, back in slavery, had went with a French regiment to help the revolutionaries fight a battle against South Carolina.
Actually, in Savannah. As a matter of fact, there's a statue.
Yes.
There's a statue to them in Savannah.
So my question is, when Leclerc came back with the Armada to take over the island via Napoleon Bonaparte's orders, and when Dessalines had the upper hand against them, why didn't the Americans send troops or reinforcements if they knew that they were going to...
To which side?
To the French. Because the French, you know, as we know in American history, were, you know, they helped the Americans against the British. So I was wondering, maybe I might be wrong, but, you know, why didn't the Americans, you know, send reinforcements to help, you know, Leclerc against the Haitians?
Well, keep in mind that a strategic imperative of the U.S. rulers, which, from their point of view,